You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we're joined by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Alan, how are we today?
Well, this is going to be very meta, just realised, because you've called me an expert. I'm not sure I warrant that, but we're going to be talking about whether we should or whether we do trust experts. So you're going to have a supposed expert talking about whether you trust experts. So
what if we can't trust you?
Exactly. That's exactly it. So the question today, well, the first question is, you know, do we trust qualified people? Do we trust experts? And I think anybody who's been paying attention over the last, 8 years or so, will probably see a gradual erosion, I think, of trust in so-called experts. And so some workers in the States set out to see whether this was the case or not, whether we are trusting experts less. And this paper's just been published in the journal Scientific Reports. And do we trust qualified people? The answer is sometimes. Okay. Sort of a yeah, but no sort of thing. So what they did, they had a whopping 2,400 participants. And they did a three-part experiment with these. So they sort of cut them into three sections. So in the first experiment, they took 208 of these 2,400 people, and they asked them what factors they thought were important when evaluating an expert. And these experts were on topics as various as skincare, nutrition, abortion, and police brutality. So you've got a bit of a mix there.
Hey, good to get a wide range.
Absolutely. And so the answers that sort of came through, you know, what are they looking for in an expert on these subjects? They're looking for people that have, say, relevant degrees. They're looking for people who've got research experience in these particular topics. They're looking for, you know, things like peer recognition, moral character, all of those sort of things that you would sort of expect. And things like height, looks, race, and sexual orientation didn't really come into the equation, okay? So, you know, they're looking for qualifications. They're looking for people who obviously know something about whatever it is that they're talking about. So that was part one of the experiment. Part two, then they took 498 of the remaining people, and they gave them fictional biographies of supposed experts, and in which the credentials of those experts were systematically varied, okay? And so, again, what they found, that most of them would trust people that had the relevant academic backgrounds. They're looking for experience. Again, they're looking for peer-recognized accomplishments, things like that. Again, you know, the sort of things that you would expect. Something like an Ivy League diploma, not a degree, but a diploma. Something like having lots of followers on social media, that also sort of came into the equation, but again, it wasn't sort of rated quite so highly as, you know, having proper degrees and proper experience and stuff like that. So again, so far so good, just probably what you would expect. Then came the clincher, the remaining 1,776 people. I don't know whether that's just totally accidental or not, seeing it's the 250th of the US. So 1,776 people. So they got them to read biographies of a fictional researcher who had written a best-selling book on abortion, okay? And so they said, right, so the researcher, the person that wrote the book supposedly was either a highly qualified doctor with lots of experience, or they were a mechanical engineer with minimal experience, okay? And the views of the researcher were also varied as well. So the researcher, the person that wrote the book, was either pro-choice, pro-life, or their preferences weren't stated, okay? Mm. Right, so, and in doing this, what they found was the most important factor on trusting the person that wrote the book was whether or not the person reading the book agreed with the views of the person who had written the book, regardless of their credentials, regardless of their experience or whatever, okay? So, sadly, it's all coming down to politics, okay? So what they found, for example, so the mechanical engineer who had the same views as the reader, even though he didn't have any expertise in the field, as long as he had the same views as the reader trusted them just as much as the doctor who hadn't stated their views, okay? So the doctor's not taking a position either way. The mechanical engineer, if he's got the same views as the reader, then the reader agrees with them. Okay, they trust them just as much as a doctor, for goodness sake. And a doctor who has a quote-unquote wrong opinion, the opposite opinion from the reader, okay, is trusted no more than the mechanical engineer. So all of a sudden, all of this credential stuff goes totally out the window, and it all comes down to your political views, because that's what this is ultimately. And that, to me, is scary.
Yeah, maybe not the best when you're trying to get expert advice.
You know, and this is not like, this is, you know, this is not a small scale thing. You know, this is 2,400 participants. This is a decent whack of people. And this is what they find, that people are swayed by opinion, essentially. They're not looking at facts. And, I mean, this is just, sadly, it's self-evident in the way that the United States is going at the moment, when you've got people like, you know, Kennedy and stuff in charge of health, you know, who has absolutely no credentials in that.
But he agrees with them.
But anybody who agrees, oh, yeah, I'll take my ivermectin, absolutely I will, you know.
And yeah.
Boy, so what they said at the end of the paper is that they haven't, you know, that humanity hasn't lost complete trust in experts, but what they seem to be doing is they're looking for people that they agree with, and hence the rise of podcasters, influencers, all of these sort of social media-y type people and everything who are espousing a view, regardless of whether they've got any bloody, you know, experience in that whatsoever, you know. And to me, this is a worry. This is a huge worry.
Yeah, not a particularly positive trend for trusting the science.
Well, you know, why be qualified then in that case? What's the point? What's the point if people aren't going to trust you? And so somehow we've got to get that trust back. And and where the hell do you start with that? I mean, you can seemingly demonstrably prove these people to be wrong, but that just doesn't seem to cut any ice in the current political climate. It just doesn't. You know, people can tell, well, people, like, I mean, you know, the president of the USA can just tell bald-faced whoppers and people believe them, you know, regardless of the evidence, doesn't matter. And that's not good for humanity, folks. That's not good.
Was this all people in the study, or was some people?
Well, this seemed to be the majority view. This seemed to be that seemed to be the thing. So, a real, real worry. So,
yeah, not a particularly joyous start to science today.
And
but
unfortunately,
it's important.
There's no easy answers out there, as far as I can see.
It's going to be something we're going to have to work on as a society. I feel, hopefully. Let's hope and pray that it could maybe get better.
Yes, indeed. Oh well. Anyway. Onto better things.
What else do you have for us today?
Well, again, if you're going to trust me when I tell you this, you know, I mean. So let's talk about solar storms, because they're pretty cool. I've never actually been up to see the Northern Lights, unfortunately. Have you guys ever been
no.
up?
No.
You know, I'd love to see that. Apparently it's absolutely, utterly breathtaking. We don't quite get the same things down here. But they result from sort of solar storms. So they're high energy particles that come out of the sun. They interact with the Earth's atmosphere and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we get all these beautiful colours and stuff. And we certainly know when they're happening. You know, they can interfere with sort of communications and stuff. And if they are sufficiently intense, then if you're up in space in a spacecraft, it can kill you. Which isn't good. And apparently during the Apollo mission, so between Apollo 16 and Apollo 17, there was a massive solar storm. And basically, if they'd been on their way to the moon at that stage, then they'd be fried. So it is dangerous. And we obviously would like to know more about them.
So we cannot get fried.
Yeah, basically, yes. Yeah. Which means being able to figure out when they occurred in the past, which is not quite so straightforward.
It doesn't seem like the easiest bit of science in the world.
No, because they don't necessarily leave tracks as well, they kind of do, as we're going to talk about, okay? So what these researchers in Okinawa in Japan have done, this is really, really quite cool. So they have used a mixture of science and literature to be able to pinpoint a solar storm that occurred between the winter of the year 1200 and the spring of the year 1201. That's which to me seems pretty darn good to be able to narrow something down to that level of precision, which is really, really seriously good. So how did they do this? Well, so what they did was the science part was carbon-14. Okay, so carbon-14 is what we use for radiocarbon dating. Okay, everyone's heard of carbon dating. So carbon-14 is a radioactive nucleus. It decays at a particular rate that we know. If we measure the amount of carbon-14 in something, we can figure out the time since it got into that something. Now, trees are particularly good for this. And what happens with these big solar storms, these, as we call them, sort of proton, solar proton events, what happens is that they give rise to carbon-14 in the atmosphere. And that carbon-14 in the atmosphere is then incorporated into anything that's living. And then we can look at that much, much, much later on. So it gets incorporated into the trees, and we can measure the carbon-14. And what we're looking for are little spikes, okay, because these solar storms give you more carbon-14 than is normally there. There's normally some carbon-14 in the atmosphere. These solar storms give you little spikes, and you can sort of then date them according to the trees, so the, you know, dendrochronology, so the tree rings, et cetera, et cetera. And you can sort of narrow things down pretty well. So what these Okinawa researchers did was they went to northern Japan, and they measured the amount of carbon-14 in the trees. And then they looked at the old Japanese literature. So there was a Japanese writer in the year 1204 who said that he saw, quote, red lights in the sky over Kyoto. And so they were sort of thinking, well, you know, maybe this was due to a solar proton event. And so they did their C-14 measurements, et cetera, dated it from the trees, found out that, yeah, that's pretty close to 1204. So they reckon between, as I said, the winter of 1200 and the spring of 1201. And also this was backed up by Chinese literature as well, because the Chinese had made some observations of these weird red skies as well that were due to sort of a, you know, a solar storm, a solar proton event and everything. So this is a lovely match there of literature and science.
That's
which
phenomenal.
I think is, it's really,
that's
really cool.
So cool.
Very, very nice. Yeah.
An awesome, it's always nice when, because it's like all the, there's a lot of parts there, right?
With the trees.
And I just think it's really cool to see those things working together, right. Especially for something that happened, you know, 800 years ago.
A long time ago. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But no, that's impressive stuff.
Hey, so that's a win for science, if you ask me.
And literature. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And what do you have for us finally?
Finally, just sort of very, very quickly, let's talk droughts. You know, we probably don't really want to, because we've all experienced droughts in relatively recent times, and we know that they are not good for the country. They do literally cost the country billions. And look, hell, if it's not a drought these days, it's a flood or something like that. We seem, you know, our weather just seems to be all up and down and all over the place, doesn't it? Of recent, you know, the past 20-odd years or something like that.
Weather events are becoming worryingly common.
Yeah. No, I absolutely don't disagree. So what people would really like to do, you know, would be to be able to predict droughts, you know, to be able to predict, oh, yeah, this could be a bad season, we'd better save the water, et cetera, et cetera. And so in order to do this, they use climate records, which are fantastically accurate, but they only really date back to the 1970s, okay? So this particular collection of climate data that people use. So it's the relatively recent past. I mean, it might not seem so for you guys, because you weren't born in 1970, but some of us, you know, were around then. So in the recent past, so we've had big droughts in 2007, 2008, and 2012, 2013. Big droughts. And again, you know, cost the country big money. However, if we go back a little bit more to last century, they certainly were not the biggest droughts by any stretch of the imagination. So we go back to the 20th century, and we find that we had way bigger droughts in 1914-15, 1907, 1908, and 1945-46. And so they were all much, much, much bigger droughts. So the worry is that if we are relying on relatively recent climate data in order to do these predictions and everything, you know, we might not be predicting the worst, let's say, because those droughts, those relatively recent droughts, you know, they were bad, but they weren't terrible, terrible like those three were.
We know we can have worse.
Yes, yes, yeah. So that's what needs to be brought in mind. So, and this was an article in The Conversation by workers at Waikato and Canterbury Universities. So I think that's, you know, just a good thing to think about, just to consider when we are looking ahead. We need to look back as well.
So, I mean, it's good to be preventative with these sort of things if we can.
Absolutely, yes.
Thanks, Alan, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. Find out what the future of fitness looks like at Sports Tech, 23rd and 24th of May, a whole weekend of fun activities focused on the innovative world of sports technology.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motet, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.